This is an ABC podcast.
This is A Big Country on RN and I'm Edwina Farley. Have you ever dreamt of downsizing, moving from the big smoke to somewhere quiet? Well, what about a place on the river? A houseboat, in fact. This week, we're off to the River Murray to meet some of the people who call this waterway their permanent home. We'll also meet a man with a special interest in Australia's unofficial national anthem, Waltzing Matilda. We'll find out how one veggie grower is reinvigorating consumer interest in the humble Brussels sprout, and go finger lime picking on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. It's a job that takes protective clothing and a good deal of care if you're going to get through the day without drawing blood.
And I'm just loving the various outfits all your pickers have.
Yeah, it's pretty standard stuff, really. Thorn-proof gloves and arm protectors, which are sort of very light Kevlar sort of material.
You're the gladiators yes. of the fruit picking world.
You could say that, yes.
Well, it's a good thing the fruit is so delicious, otherwise it might never get picked. That story coming up. But first, let's kick back and relax and go messing about on the river.
Good afternoon. How are you going, Lynn?
Catherine, I'm very well, thank you.
And this is home?
Yes, it is home. Mobile home.
Do you mind if I take a look?
Not at all. Come in. Just don't fall off the gangplank.
Have you ever dreamed of living on a houseboat? Not just for a holiday, but spending every day out on the river? Well, it's a way of life for quite a few people who call the River Murray their permanent home. Hello, I'm Catherine Hoytzenroder. The lower reaches of the river are perfect for messing about on boats. The river is wide and smooth, and the houseboats can travel up and down its lengths through a series of locks and weirs.
What's the go with that gangplank there?
That gangplank there is can be treacherous sometimes.
We've made it across. Wow, look at this.
Everything you need to live a normal life, just able to untie and move off whenever we have the inclination.
Today I'm catching up with a few of these river dwellers to find out what draws them to a life on the water. First up, it's retired PE teacher Lynn Davison and her husband Ron, who have moored their custom-built houseboat at Berry in South Australia's Riverland. They moved onto Linny's tinny at the start of the year and have already discovered the benefits of waking up on the river every morning.
The view for a start, I mean, you can't beat waking up to that. And in the evening, some of the sunsets are stunning, particularly when you move away and you know, out upriver or downriver, you wake up and sunsets and sunrises are beautiful. Freedom. You can just untie and go whenever you know, if you feel like moving anytime, going for a trip, untie and go. It's take everything with you.
What went through your head when you started to have this idea, Ron, of having a houseboat and living on a houseboat? Did you have any concerns?
The biggest concern I think we've got is age, because living on a houseboat tends to be a bit more active. You've got to do pumping out yourself, water you've got to look after, gas you've got to look after. So you've got to be, and it's fine, we're both fit and healthy, but the big fear is what would happen if something would be to happened to one of us, yeah.
Moored further upstream from Lynn and Ron is Rodney West. The 73-year-old has weathered more than 20 years on this boat, which he built himself. It's a much more humble affair than the modern houseboats which ply the river today, but it's given Rodney a unique lifestyle.
So I've travelled the river from one end to the other a couple of times, you know. Recently just come back from Gawler for a trip down there. Keeps me off the streets.
Well, you're moored here, really nice spot here at Lyrup.
Yeah.
How long have you been here for?
16 years we've been moored in here. You're out of the wind, you've got the deep side of the river, and you're only a couple of kilometres from the town. You get all the signals for the phones and so on, you know, the internet and all the rest of it, so there you go.
A potbelly stove keeps Rodney warm during the cold winter months on the river. He has solar panels on the roof and a generator for his electrical needs. He also keeps chooks and grows vegetables on a block of land that he owns near the mooring.
I know I've got 12 volt on board, everything's 240, the fridge and everything else, and it's all 240, you know, and the TV and the rest of it, you know.
Yep.
So,
we're so not... you, because I've heard you, I mean, you're playing your radio, so you'll run the radio,
on
you,
240,
you
can,
yeah, and the TV.
Yeah, 240.
Do you have any aircon? What do you do when it gets really hot?
Out the window. And luckily, I've got a swimming pool outside my back door.
So when it's 46 here in the Riverland,
yeah,
you just
go for a swim about every hour.
Yeah,
that's about all I do.
Do you have any bricks and mortar investments, or is this
no,
you know, is this
nothing.
This is home? This is everything.
This is it. This and this piece of land. Yeah.
What would cause you to leave the boat and to move into a house?
Death.
So this is it. This is where you're living. This is where you're living out.
How am I going to improve myself? I've looked at it plenty of times. How will I improve myself by selling up here and moving? And I can't see any improvement. So, you know, this is it. Mm. Now take me out boots first.
It all sounds very idyllic, but sometimes the dream lifestyle can turn into a nightmare. A few years ago, an uninsured houseboat sank in the River Murray, leaving its owner homeless, broke, and facing hefty fines if she didn't remove the wreckage from the water. And even if the houseboat does stay afloat, it's unlikely to increase in value in the same way as a bricks and mortar home. Joanne Seaton and Steve Kitty understand only too well the downsides to living on the water, but they wouldn't have it any other way.
You don't do it to make money as you would with a house or hope to get some capital gain. Every year it is worth less, I guess. But the lifestyle was just fantastic.
So how did you make that decision, guys, to move on to a houseboat?
That's a very long backstory. we've always been involved with the water, water skiing when we were younger, sailing for 30-odd years. We actually built a catamaran to sail off into the sunset, and that didn't work for a whole range of reasons, but sold the business and decided we wanted to come up and be with our kids up in the Riverland and didn't want to live back on a... on land, so we decided we'd get a houseboat built, and this was built in Loxton about 8 years ago. You come home from wherever and it's like you're on holiday.
So that feeling, I mean, you've been here how many years now?
Six and a bit.
So that feeling of being on a holiday, that hasn't sort of eroded over time?
No. Well, we're sitting here now looking at the view on a chilly winter's day and lovely and warm. It's just great. We just love it.
Yeah, no, it hasn't changed. As I said, Steve built a 42-foot catamaran, did all the electrical and plumbing and whatnot, and we lived on that for about 3 years, and we just loved being on the water. So, and this is a lot bigger than our catamaran, so it's, you know, really comfortable.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, excuse me again, I guess the thing is, it's a minimalist lifestyle, but we'd already done that, so we live that way anyhow, but you can't have four wardrobes worth of clothes. I think a lot of people in some of the rental houseboats expect that you can have a normal shower for 15 minutes and all 10 of you can do it and you're not going to run out of water. Well, we've never had that issue because we've lived in a yacht and whatever, and so we're aware of that, and so showers here are luxurious. It's just like a normal shower for us. So
mm-hmm. It's very private.
Yeah.
We just shift across to the hotel over there on the dinghy and our little putt-putt thing, and whenever we can sort of avoid driving, we take the boat somewhere across the football club we used to.
So if you want to go and have a meal at the pub, you just get in the dinghy.
Hop in the dinghy, yep.
Yeah, we had friends over from Tassie and we did the same thing. We just took them for a pup up and down the river and then across to the hotel for something different. They loved it.
Push a branch down. This fruit here, very nice. These here, this size, 30 millimetres, is all right.
Bob Schultz is a finger lime grower on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. He's instructing his pickers on how best to approach the thorny bushes to get to the fruit. It's a job that takes protective clothing and a good deal of care if you're going to get through the day without drawing blood.
You look in here, you find more and more fruit that you can't see. You can't see it from the outside. You've got to pull the branch down so you can see in there. Don't pull it too close to you though, like here. Otherwise, the spines will get you.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols. Finger limes are a tasty and versatile native fruit. Some people describe them as the caviar of the citrus world. They come in a variety of colours, tiny green, yellow, red and pink balls, just bursting with flavour. Bob Schultz planted out this orchard at Wamuran around 4 years ago and has now got about 1,200 shrubs growing in neat rows.
Now, finger limes,
absolutely delicious. Pop in your mouth, perfect with salads, champagne, you name it.
Yes, very good with seafood and very good in custards, mousses, cream cheese, all those sorts of spread type things. Very good food decoration as well.
But Bob Schultz, they're an absolute bugger to pick.
They are a little tricky and they are a little difficult to pick, but it's, you know, you get used to it.
How many times have you been scratched to the point of drawing blood?
Many, many times. And a person my age doesn't take much to break my skin. But you have to learn how to handle them. You can, like all thorn trees, you can run your hand one way up a branch and it won't affect you at all. But if you run it the other way, you're in real trouble.
Any horticulture industry finds it hard to get pickers and maintain pickers. How do they go with the finger limes? Have you
had? They don't mind. It's not a terribly onerous job in the sense of bending or whatever, because they're really picking at standing height most of the time.
And I'm just loving the various outfits all your pickers have.
Yeah, it's pretty standard stuff, really. Thorn-proof gloves and arm protectors, which are sort of very light Kevlar sort of material.
You're the gladiators yes. of the fruit picking world.
You could say that, yes.
Like with them, what you're saying about the different varieties and their potential spikiness?
They're interesting to work with. Certainly a lot more challenging than most trees would be. Just some can, like depending on the variety, some will have larger spikes, some will have shorter. The shorter can be harder spikes and hurt more than the long spikes, but yeah, you just sort of gotta, you learn your varieties.
Learn to be prepared.
Yeah, yeah. Prepared.
How much blood have you drawn?
Oh, drawn blood a couple of times, but yeah, I've had me fair share of scratches.
Yeah. But oh, the fruit at the end.
Yeah, the fruit is good. It's really rewarding when you can see a whole big tray of fruit and think, oh yeah, I worked for that and I put in effort and finally I've got some results out of these trees.
How long have you been involved with the farm?
About a year now. Been here since the second stage was just bare earth, so it's been interesting to watch it grow and learn the process and all that, yeah.
Oh, there's so much to learn in terms of how to cultivate this native plant.
Yeah, there's heaps, like we're still learning. There's new problems every day. There's no real literature about it, like about the issues you get with it or how to grow it, so.
Real pioneering work.
Yeah, yep, certainly.
I've been doing field work for a long time, but yeah, this is my first time picking finger limes.
So you got your gear?
Yep.
Okay, Kieran Brown, are you ready?
Yes. And just for the record, if this is going to the media, I'm single and I need a cowboy.
Finger lime picker Karen Brown, leaving everyone a bit speechless there on Bob Schultz's farm on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. Well, here's hoping she finds her cowboy. You're listening to A Big Country. Still to come, we'll meet the man who's donating his entire collection of Waltzing Matilda recordings to Winton in outback Queensland. And the much maligned vegetable, the Brussels sprout, gets a new lease on life.
So they're a funny-looking thing. They're a bit of an alien-looking species. They grow on a long, thin stalk, and the sprouts themselves grow off the side of the stalk. You know, they're in nice, neat little rows on the stalk in a slight sort of spiral fashion. Yeah, they're funny-looking things, but they're great, you know. They look good, and they taste even better because they're on the stalk, so, yeah.
Do you know what vegetable Ben Young is talking about? It's the much maligned brassica, the Brussels sprout. Hello, I'm Margot Kelly. Ben and his family are veggie growers in Yolla in Tasmania's northwest. They've gone back to basics to reinvigorate consumer demand for the humble sprout.
Nice one's just here. You have to take some with you. Keep the family happy.
Rather than sell them individually, they've decided to leave the sprouts on the stalk, which they then sell through their local veggie shed outlet. It saves on labour in the paddock, and consumers seem to like the bizarre-looking plant.
So this is a Brussels sprout plant. Like I said, they're a strange-looking plant. You know, all the sprouts grow on a stalk. We just cut them off like this, but they're a terrific little plant. You can even eat them fresh, straight out of the paddock if you like. If you're an absolute Brussels sprout nut, you can just munch on them. So, you know, they're great little things.
Are they a popular item? Are they coming back into fashion?
Sprouts are funny. Like, you know, I can hardly get my kids to eat them, but since I've been producing our own sprouts and cooking them in the way that we like them, they seem to like to eat them. But even our customers, you know, like some people absolutely love sprouts and they'll bend over backwards to get some fresh sprouts. But then other customers, you know, they just walk straight past them. It's not their thing. But I think with the way we've been selling these sprouts on their stalk, we've reintroduced sprouts into a few people's menus. So,
why do you leave them, the individual sprouts, on the stalk when you're selling them at the store?
Well, we started off by picking the sprouts off by hand, which was uneconomical just for the time factor. So we sort of, you know, we looked at it and thought, well, how are we going to, if we're going to continue growing sprouts, how are we going to do this in a way that's sustainable for us, that's easy and efficient and quick? And we thought, well, and my father suggested it, said, well, how about we try selling them just straight on their stalk as they grow in the paddock? And it's taken off from there.
From the consumers? How have they responded?
Well, we only had a few the first year, and as soon as we finished for the season, for the next 3-4 months, they were coming in saying, where are these sprouts on the stalk? We want more of these sprouts on their stalk. So we thought, hey, well, let's keep doing this, you know. It worked well.
There's so many ways that vegetable producers are looking at value-adding the product. This is sort of a step back and saying, no, we'll actually keep it simple. We'll minimise labour, and it's, you know, boosted the consumer interest.
Well, I feel like we're a little bit going back into prehistoric days doing it like this, because this is how it would have been done for the last however many, you know, thousands of years that sprouts have been on the earth. But, yeah, like it works for us. I wouldn't say it's overly innovative, but, you know, we saw how it needed to be done to make it efficient for us, and our customers like it like this. So, you know, we're just going to keep doing it like this.
Well, we'd like to do a song that I learned from my friend Cole Joy in Sydney about 10 years ago, and I'd like to translate in case you don't know what the words mean. It's kind of like the national anthem in Australia almost. Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong. Now what I'm trying to say is, once a happy hobo camped by a cool pool. Under the shade.
That's Johnny Cash performing arguably Australia's most famous song. But did you know the country music legend's version of Waltzing Matilda is just one of more than 800 recordings of the song known to exist in the world? I certainly didn't.
Under the shade of the coolie bar tree.
G'day, I'm Michael Cavanagh. Well, one person who knows just about everything there is to know about this song is Peter Burgess. He's a former director of sound recordings at the National Library in Canberra, but now calls Port Macquarie on the mid-north coast of New South Wales home. Peter spent years collecting recordings of this Aussie classic and has now donated them to the newly reopened Waltzing Matilda Centre in Winton, outback Queensland.
It's a song which every Australian knows. If they don't know it, they've got to learn it. And so it's part of our fabric. Originally, we thought there were about 300, then 400. The last count I've done, it shows that there's probably at least probably over 800 or 900 recordings around the world, starting in 1927 up to today. And it occurs in so many formats. It's in medleys of Australiana. It's a song which lends itself to any interpretation by almost any musical style. So you've got Waltzing Matilda in jazz, you've got it in folk music, you've got it in brass bands, you've got it in gospel, you've got it in symphony orchestras play it, it's sung at football grand finals. It's more or less everywhere. And I think that's what makes it so admired and respected by Australians.
The song itself, it was around a long time. It was first performed publicly in Winton, but it really wasn't as popular in its early days as it's become. Why is that?
I suppose you can put it down to the sound recording industry, because in those days, this is before the films talked, it's before television, and often before radio, and so people used to get their entertainment from sound recordings or gramophone recordings. And it was when it became so well known, especially during the 1930s and 40s on sound recordings, that it became universally acceptable, and it was heard on radio all the time. And Australians, I've always said, sing it no matter where they are. It's sung in many languages. It's sung in just about every European language. It's sung in Japanese, Indonesian. Just about, there are recordings of it more or less taken from around the world.
I'm a jumbuck to drink at the Billabong. I've got the swag and grabbed him with glee.
The first recording that you've got goes back to 1927, and that was on a 78. Are you sure that that is the first recording?
Well, it's all the study we've done and all the questions I've asked indicate that. But in this game, you never know. Something can always happen to upset things.
And the recording's made all around the world. What are some of the countries that have made it quite popular?
Well, I would say England and the United States are the main ones. The United States, particularly during the Second World War, because an Australian, Marjorie Lawrence, who is one of our great sopranos, took to it and recorded it. A black singer by the name of Josh White, who was a blues man, he recorded it. And so did many others. And so it became popular. And the Americans have always had a close connection with it, because in England and London, it was also very popular. But there are also versions by French singers. And it's and of course, in Australia, just about everyone who has a voice has a go.
Do you think, particularly in those early days, the Americans and the French, the blues singers and the jazz singers, knew what a jumbuck was, for example?
I'm sure they had no idea whatsoever. It was probably put to them to sing it by the recording companies, and I doubt if they would have been. Although, to be fair, quite a few singers like Tex Morton and Smokey Dawson and others have as a preamble to singing it, explain what some of the terms are. And even on the YouTube, there's a version by Johnny Cash. And Johnny, before he starts to sing it, explains what a jumbuck and a billabong are and so on.
I translated, see, a jumbuck is a kind of little animal. Well, it's halfway in between a big jackrabbit and a little deer. They call a jumbuck to drink at the billabong. Up jumped a swagman and grabbed him with glee.
You've mentioned jazz and blues and traditional. Any punk or hard rock versions that you know of?
Yes, there's David Evans and Thundering Rock. Probably one of the most curious versions is Dame Edna Everidge, Barry Humphries, who does a rock version of it, Rock Matilda. And, of course, another rock version is Bill Haley, Rockin' Around Australia. And so it has been, as I say, it lends itself to interpretation in many styles.
You've spent so much putting this collection together. Why then wave it goodbye to Winton?
Well, I suppose advancing years tell on you and you start to... Well, let me explain it this way. For many years, I spent my time looking at deceased estates and seeing what people had left behind, often making no provision to send their collections or items to a good home. So I'm now in my 80s, as I thought to myself, right, time has come to plan ahead and sort of find a place where it would be looked after. I found that Winton were enthusiastic. They have a lot of passion for it. And I'm sure they're going to treat it with respect and, above all, keep the collection growing rather than just taking it in and storing it.
How much of a wrench, though, was it to wave goodbye to what would be almost equal to your children?
Well, my children actually were easier to get rid of. No, it's not easy in one way, but it's relieving in another because you are confident that it's found a good home, and that's very satisfying.
Well, whoever knew there were so many recordings of Waltzing Matilda, and I have to say some are.
better than others. Peter Burgess there, a former director of sound recordings at the National Library in Canberra. He's giving his entire collection to the Waltzing Matilda Centre in Winton in outback Queensland. That's the program for this week. Thanks to Ari Gross for technical production. Don't forget you can listen to us anytime via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Edwina Farley. Bye for now.